Welcome back to another episode of the PRT Podcast, where we teach actual patients how to heal from chronic symptoms and break down the tools they use. My name is John Gaseneca. I'm a therapist and the director of clinical research and development at the Pain Psychology Center in Los Angeles. Chronic diseases are diseases of uncertainty. When you're in long-term discomfort, you face questions that are impossible to answer. Questions like, did I hurt myself permanently? Or why is this happening to me? Or will this ever go away? The bad news is no one can answer these questions for you with the perfect certainty you crave. The good news is you don't need to be 100% certain to break free of symptoms. The solution to this riddle is actually letting go of trying to understand everything all at once, and instead simply figuring out how to just feel a little bit safer in the very moment you're in. This might mean different things at different times, but if you can accomplish this task over and over again, instead of getting stuck in rumination, your nervous system will calm down and your symptoms will fade out of your awareness. For some people, this method of soothing and relaxing instead of overthinking is an intuitive switch. But as you'll see with the patient I meet with today, for a lot of very intelligent, analytical people, this pivot can feel like learning a new language. Today's episode is about learning how to feel safer right now, even when your brain is dead set on overanalyzing. And I have an amazing doctor and pain expert, Dr. Becca Kennedy, joining me today to help show you how to get on the path to recovery. As always, the PRT Podcast is brought to you by the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Center, a training center where thousands of doctors, therapists, nurses, and coaches have learned how to treat and eliminate their patients' chronic conditions. If you'd like to become a PRT practitioner and support the podcast, use the coupon code HEAL10 to get 10% off training at painreprocessingtherapy.com. Now, before we get started, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is presented solely for general information and entertainment purposes and is not intended as a substitute for the advice of a physician, psychotherapist, or other professional healthcare service. If you have specific medical concerns or questions, please contact your personal healthcare provider. Now let's meet my guest for today's show. All right, so joining me today is Dr. Becca Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is a board-certified family medicine physician with over 2 decades of experience in treating patients before founding Resilience Healthcare, where she specializes in the treatment of neuroplastic conditions. Dr. Kennedy led a long COVID specialty group with Kaiser Permanente. As a board member with the Association for the Treatment of Neuroplastic Symptoms, Dr. Kennedy has become one of the leading and incredibly compassionate advocates for getting people out of pain. Dr. Kennedy, I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thanks, John. Really excited to be here.
I got introduced to your work by Dr. Schubner, and I've been watching your YouTube clips and podcast interviews. You have such a compassionate voice for people that are getting out of pain. And for having been a doctor for 20 years, what was the breaking point for you to get more into this chronic symptom work and the psychological aspects behind it?
Well, as a primary care doctor, I first worked in a migrant farm worker clinic for 5 years, and then I moved to Kaiser Permanente. And 10 years into my career, I mean, as anyone knows, in Kaiser Permanente, we see a lot of patients. And I think we're in a really unique vantage point as a primary care doctor at Kaiser, where we have such huge volume and we're a closed system to really see the patterns of what's going on over time with people. And just noticing the pattern in many, many, many patients that didn't get better with all of the different interventions and specialists and everything that we could possibly try, that often it was the same sort of symptoms that happened in the same sort of people. Often there was mental health diagnoses that neither caused the symptoms nor were the result of the symptoms exactly. It was just more they were sort of coexisting. And then often people were more likely to have had a history of trauma. Not always, but just seeing this pattern over and over and over. And it's really hard. I was frustrated along with my patients that they would just keep coming back over and over and over. And I would try everything under the sun. And as a primary care physician, they come back to us and there was nowhere else to go. But it sort of became this curiosity for me, sort of like this itch I couldn't scratch, that we were missing something huge in medicine. And so I just started this journey to figure out what that was. And I just kept looking and looking and looking for years, really. And I just never was quite there. I would find some information about the the nervous system, but yet those tools weren't enough. And so finally, a friend of mine from medical school is the one that told me about Howard Schubiner, and I found this work and then just really dove right in.
So the patient we're going to hear from today, she was given the diagnosis of vulvodynia, which is a diagnosis that doesn't have a clear cause, isn't often given a clear treatment. Are idiopathic labels like vulvodynia helpful, or do they sometimes cause more harm than good?
Gosh, it's such a good question about, I think the line between sort of validating people's very real, often terrible experience with the symptoms, and then also understanding, explaining it, and also not worsening the problem. I do think it's helpful, something like that. In general, I think that's helpful. So we have the validation, you know, that, you know, this is going on. And I think with, you know, there's lots of different diagnoses that, like vulvodynia, that it's really more of a description of the symptoms rather than, you know, something deeper. But, you know, I think it can be helpful in this circumstance.
Well, I'm really excited to show you this patient. Well, let's get to it. So, Sarah, why don't you catch me up on what this has been like since the pain started?
So I started having discomfort around November of last year for what turned out to be this weirdly presenting yeast infection that they didn't catch for like too long. So I finally got treatment for that in December. And then the initial set of symptoms, which is a very uncomfortable burning, subsided. And I was very happy for about a day. And I was like, this is done. And I had like a day where I felt totally normal. And I was like, this is incredible. And then I woke up the next day and I had a new different pain, but what I would call like actual pain. And I just got trapped in this loop of going to like urgent care and here and there. Like, I think that was what made it unbelievably stressful, because I was like, this is happening. I know this is happening. I'm trying to communicate that I'm in discomfort and like, you know, whatever, we can get into that. I think I have a lot of lingering anger about that period. But when it turned to just this sort of 24/7 pain that was pretty intense at the beginning, it has subsided in the, you know, months since, but it was just absolutely terrifying, because at that point I got retested for everything and everything came back clear. So now I was like triple sure that nothing was wrong. And I just had now this like unexplainable pain. I did have like, I was like, I guess lucky enough that like I finally got to see my doctor, who's my doctor now, who did say, I think it's just your nervous system. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And I was diagnosed with vulvodynia, which I also found to be, on one hand, I guess it's good to have some kind of label. But on the other, when I realized that all it meant was you have pain and that it was like a diagnosis of exclusion, yeah, I was just, I guess, angry, saddened. It just seemed so hopeless. It's like, oh, okay, here you go. You have pain. We don't know why. Best of luck. I mean, it wasn't exactly like that. I got referred to a PT and, you know, there was some sense of like, maybe we can do something about this. But, you know, then you go and you Google it and it's all despair. I don't know. It felt like I had fallen into a very deep hole and nightmarish, and I had no way to crawl back out. Yeah.
So just right off the bat, what are some of your first reactions to hearing that clip?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, so common, that experience in just so many different places in the body and, you know, all of that. And it is a deep despair. I mean, if you have these symptoms, that the people, that the experts that you're going to that are supposed to have the solutions don't have solutions. And she talked about, you know, at first she felt like they were just saying, okay, bye-bye, good luck. And then she said, well, no, they didn't do that exactly. You know, they sent me to a PT. But at some point, you do get to that end of the road. You've seen the PT and you've seen the, you know, this and that and everyone under the sun. And so people do get to that end of the rope. And it is a terrible sense of despair. And just like we were talking about before, having a label can be a little bit helpful because, you know, we're saying, hey, yeah, here's something that lots of other people have. And But then to find out that there's not an answer for it in the mainstream medical system is very disparaging.
Yeah, that disparaging feeling comes up in so many patients and can really turn into a medical trauma. A lot of emotions come up because of mm-hmm. it. Why do you think it's helpful to learn how to cope with those emotions, not even from the traumas in your past, but just the trauma of being in pain and not knowing what to do?
Oh my gosh, 100%. I mean, not only just the emotions that are there around experiencing that suffering, but also around the anger towards the doctors and the system. And it's perfectly normal to feel angry, even if your doctors and medical providers are really caring and showing that empathy and doing everything they can to help. But unfortunately, a lot of times that's not how patients feel either. And so all of those emotions around all of it are so important.
Well, it's good to hear. And I could see how doctors are hesitant to bring up this idea that it's neuroplastic in the first place, because there can be a lot of anger with finding out that it is something to do with your nervous system as well. Have you ever had that experience where somebody has an adverse reaction to the suggestion that their symptoms are neuroplastic?
Yes. And before I learned about this approach and the language to use and the science to explain, I think a lot of physicians in medicine understand that there's some sort of stress involved, or that it's the nervous system, or it's the anxiety or depression. It's just, we don't have the right language and we don't exactly say it right. So I actually think that there's many physicians that do present this, but just don't have the right language nor the right solutions. And then a lot of times patients get angry at them. I mean, that definitely happened to me over and over. And then I think that then makes you just stop even saying that as a physician, understandably. When I learned this new language and the new science, it was when I was working at Kaiser and I was in the integrative department. So already people seeing me, thought I was doing something a little bit different than the medical system, but it still was within Kaiser. And I was very afraid to have this conversation with patients. But I did, and I was actually surprised at how many people were actually on board with it. Mm-hmm. Because I think if you have a different, and I didn't know how to say the language very well when I began, right? So I was still practicing that and figuring it out. But I think that when you really lean in and look at someone in the eyes and allow them to have their story heard and really hear them first, and then give them the reassurance that I've seen other patients like this, and there's new science, and then we can explain the science. And if we really connect up with them in an entirely different way in the communication, that they're so much more receptive than I think that we think they'll be. And many of my patients, especially my patients with long COVID, said to me, wow, this is the first thing a doctor said to me that actually makes sense. And that was what was really encouraging to me to actually just keep going with this. And yes, there were a few patients that got really angry with me, and it's hard. It's really hard. But fortunately, it wasn't very many.
That's really good to hear. So Sarah's been trying all the tools to get out of pain, but hasn't quite found a solution yet. And what this usually tells me is something's getting in the way of Sarah's brain feeling safe. So usually in this scenario, I like to check in on what her experience has been like to see if there are any clues as to what's keeping her nervous system so active. What are you feeling right now? What comes up when you think about this idea of being in this hole?
A lot of powerlessness,
yeah.
Frustration. I have always been able to fix things. And I think realizing that I was trying so hard to fix this, and every tool in my toolkit that I've developed throughout my whole life was no good. That was terrifying as well. I'm like, I guess to get out of this, I have to develop a whole new skill set to just sort of have a baseline comfort in my body again.
Yeah,
and I feel incredibly isolated, which I realize is, I think the more that you read about people in pain, you realize it's the thing that connects so many people is that feeling of isolation, which is almost a paradox. But I think no one in my immediate context kind of got what I was going through, and I feel like something about pelvic pain too, which is so intimate and so personal. And I think there's a sense of, you know, certainly my family, which I don't think is exceptional in this way, is not that comfortable talking about people's pelvic areas, mine included. So it was very much like, the feeling that I got was like, well, you're fine. The doctor checked you out. You're fine. So can we stop talking about this? And it was like, oh, okay. I am glad that I'm healthy, but also I'm in like some days 8 out of 10 pain all day. Like I got, so anyway, I think it was that very confusing, very initially disempowering. So I think I'm sure like the last few months for me have been realizing that and developing the patience to understand that even if it's not a quick fix, there is an afterwards. But it's tough. I think it's the hardest thing I've ever had to do, like as a person.
So I actually started my career in mental health on a suicide crisis line. I was a counselor. And one of the best things I learned from that training is the worst thing you could say to somebody on a crisis line is it's all going to be okay, because there's a piece of them that feels terribly scared and lonely. And where you want to start is kind of sit in the darkness with people. And I can imagine as a doctor, there's this impulse to want to fix, but I see so much compassion in you and hearing people's stories. Why do you think it's helpful to kind of stay in the darkness with them for a little bit before you run into fixing them?
Gosh, that's so beautiful. And yeah, absolutely. And I think first, people need to be heard and we need to connect with people. And if we are saying that they're going to be okay, even if we genuinely believe that because we have seen other people in that circumstance and, you know, on and on, if their brain, if their conscious and unconscious and nervous system is not believing that right then that sort of makes them feel like we're not hearing them. And we're not connecting with them. And it's actually, frankly, can be actually not that much different than the doctor in the clinic, you know, sort of not hearing them as well. And I think also, because we really understand their suffering, like if we don't understand their suffering, how are we going to be able to actually help them? But if we don't really first understand the degree of the suffering, then I think their protection is still going to be up and they're not going to be able to just sort of relax down into believing and trusting us.
Sarah's dealing with a tremendous amount of loneliness. You can hear it with her experiences with her family. And I see this in every patient. Why is chronic pain such a lonely experience?
Gosh, for so many different reasons. I mean, certainly just like she said, when there's certainly a body part that's just uncomfortable to talk about in the first place, and many of the areas are. So, you know, that's uncomfortable. Often chronic pain, you look fine. You maybe look very healthy. Like I'm sure she looks healthy. And so it's sort of what can be considered even like sort of an invisible illness. And so their family members just can't relate. And especially if they haven't gone through it themselves, maybe even they believed how much suffering there was in initially, and maybe they were very compassionate with them, but often as time goes on and they've seen specialists and gone to doctors, I think that compassion can wane from the family members. And then, you know, so they don't have that part. And then it's just hard to go out and be in the world and connect with people. And so many patients that have said to me, well, I thought I had all these friends, but they've really dropped off. And I don't think it's even necessarily that the people don't care about them or they don't like them. But I mean, there is a certain sort of reciprocity that you sort of need to have in order to maintain friendships. And so all of those different pieces just really get broken away.
So what Sarah is feeling is completely normal and natural and not something to be feared.
Yeah.
But it's something I want her to help process so she can move on to feeling better. So let's take a listen as she takes her next step. Let's stick with this emotion that's coming up, because I think, you know, what makes it so difficult to get out of pain is that this is a traumatic experience, just being in pain. And those emotions that come up from the trauma often block you from writing these new neural pathways because they put you on such high alert. And so let's start out with just dealing with these emotions before we go into any of the like logical brain stuff.
Yeah.
I want you to just close your eyes for a moment. And I want you to just feel that despair, feel that hopelessness coming up and just allow it to be there. There's so much in the pain journey where you want to fight that. And just let that piece of you that feels horribly hopeless and horribly scared come up. And as you're feeling these sensations, I almost want you to imagine you're in a life raft with this emotional piece of your brain. And they're terrified. And we just need a piece of you to be the one member in the life raft who's actually the caretaker. And so I don't want you to tell them to quiet down. I want you to tell them, tell me about how hopeless this has been. But take on this role of the compassionate, empathetic leader of your brain. And just let it know, of course you feel that way. I don't have to tell you to be quiet anymore. Kind of be the family member you want to have. And let that piece of you know, this is horrifying. You go on the internet and you find an idiopathic diagnosis that says this is just pain and there's nothing we can do for you. Oh my God. So let that piece of you know I was there when you saw that and it was so scary. And just encourage that piece of you to feel as hopeless as it wants. Almost as if it's on the ground in the life raft and you just say, I'm just standing over you. I'm not going to let anything happen to you. But you're allowed to feel this way. And just feel that connection with yourself. And how does that feel?
It feels like a kind of softening. I think I've been so afraid of being afraid because, of course, the messaging you get immediately is like, you have to get out of fear.
Yeah.
And I think this part has felt very much like, I don't know, there's like a shame around being afraid.
Yes.
And yeah, it's good to connect with it and to be like, it's okay. I think for so long it felt like, you know, that nightmare that you have where you try to scream at the top of your lungs and nothing comes out. It's a really hard feeling to be in a sustained manner.
If there's one thing I want your brain to understand in this session, it's that idea of we want to decrease the fear, that's step two. That happens on its own when you do the right step one. And the first step one is to actually feel that emotion, let it come up. And if we give you the right tools to where it doesn't totally take over, to where like everybody in the life raft isn't panicking, and one person's still there to take care of the other part of your brain, that piece of your brain feels heard, it feels validated. And now when you want to give it messages of safety, your brain doesn't have its heels locked in. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think it's something that I'm very unused to, like connecting to those parts of yourself, because I think, again, before this experience, I've always been able to push through.
Yeah.
I think I've been a little bit dysregulated a lot of my life. And I just had this flashback of being in the fifth grade and sort of puking from stress before school every day because I was so concerned about performing academically in the fifth grade. So maybe it's okay if it takes you a little bit of time to learn a new way of being, but is it really hard to quiet that part of your brain that is like, but can I just push a button somewhere and have this be over?
So Sarah says there she gets this flashback where she realizes she's kind of been dysregulated for a lot of her life. Why do you think it's helpful for a patient to make those type of realizations to see where this stress has been coming from?
Because often the situation that's happening for us in the moment as an adult, we may not be able to recognize why that's having such a huge impact. Like, why is my brain responding to something that doesn't actually seem that stressful to me? I've gone through all these other stresses in my life in the past and I didn't respond like this. Why am I doing it now? So really making the connection of where did your brain learn that as a child? And then why is it over responding? Gosh, it's such a huge piece. And then also, I think recognizing how when we are chronically living in patterns that don't serve us and we're a little bit dysregulated, that it's really those patterns that don't help us. I was talking to a clinician in this world, and he was talking about how patients say, I just want to go back to how I was right, you know, before these symptoms started. And he was like, no, actually, trust me, you don't. We want to get to those patterns that was laying the foundation of why your brain then created these symptoms.
It's such a common experience for people to just say, like, I wish I could just turn the clock back. And when they do go through this process, I agree. They find this voice that says, like, no, that I don't want to go back to that. That wasn't a good way of living.
Yeah.
But it can be definitely hard to see when you're in the thick of it.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm.
I so relate to Sarah in this clip where she's like, this is just not a skill I'm used to. It was a skill I was not taught, self-compassion or taking it easy on myself. How did you learn to be compassionate to yourself? Was this a childhood thing? Was this an adult thing?
This was an adult thing. This was a this work thing. I mean, I have all the personality traits. Like, I wasn't puking in fifth grade, but I definitely had a lot of pressure on myself. And that I have found is the key. If you can teach someone's unconscious brain that they deserve unconditional love, the nervous system can just let go. And there's just so many reasons that people's brain didn't learn it. I mean, sometimes certainly it was, you know, egregious abuse, absolutely obvious when that happens. But so many other times it wasn't egregious. It was a loving parent that wanted them to succeed, so put a lot of pressure on them, or maybe a parent that was ill, but still very loving, a lovely household, or just so many reasons. And that's just a protective mechanism that our brain learned just because we were a kid, just because we went through. And really getting to the root of that is key. And I find, like, for myself and for my patients, is that I found the emotional work can be so helpful in that. Like, you know, one technique that I use is the emotional awareness and expression therapy. And for people to be able to express their anger when they're not being, you know, if they weren't treated in the way that they deserve, that shows their unconscious brain that they do actually deserve to be treated well. But then to finish it with really bringing in the self-love and let that emotion fill their body as they're thinking about themselves as a child or whatever they went through is really key.
And take it from both Dr. Kennedy and I, who learned these skills in adulthood, it just takes time, right? Like, how long did it take you to learn how to be compassionate and vent those emotions and listen to yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it took me a couple of years, for sure. Yeah, you know, and I'm still learning. We're all learning. It's a journey.
And I think a good thing to point out, too, is that it is a journey, and you can get out of pain pretty quickly in the journey. You know, for a lot of people, it's getting out of pain, and then it's maybe anxiety comes up, or maybe it's just being a more joyful person. That's the next stage in the journey. But sometimes I find that patients get overwhelmed with this idea of, like, I have to clear out all these emotional cobwebs before I get out of pain. And it's often maybe 10-15% of the work before they can start making a change. Does that feel true in your line of work?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, there's different reasons for the pain or other symptoms to be there. One of them can certainly be the pain fear loop, and that can get dialed down relatively quickly, and then sort of getting deeper down into the root of it. And I think it's also, I often say, it's not easy, but it's more possible than you think it is.
I like that. Well, so what we've been talking about so far is good in theory to have clients feel their emotions, have them come up. But we also want to teach people how to deal with that frustration, as Dr. Kennedy was talking about, with some expression, to actually help the nervous system process these emotions and not get held back. So let's take a listen. And do you feel any frustration coming up about this situation?
A lot of frustration. And I'm also... This is something I've been working on, is, like, I've always had a lot of trouble expressing anger for various reasons. I think certainly that was a taboo emotion in my family of origin, where, like, you couldn't get angry. It was just not an available option. And I have, because of course I'm angry. I'm so angry about my experience. Why were my complaints not taken seriously? Why was that? My discomfort minimized. It's unacceptable.
Yes.
And I'm part of this sort of long line of women who get disbelieved in a medical setting and whose pain is not treated seriously. And it produced me a great harm. Like, I was so hurt by that. And even now, see, I'm getting sad. And I think it's because it's so hard for me to access anger that I go to sadness first.
Totally.
And I don't like that. I know I'm doing it and I don't like it. But it's like, oh gosh, that feeling of exteriorizing anger and directing it towards someone. That is, that's a tough one for me.
This will be a quick way to kind of speed up that learning. I want you to close your eyes and use that almost that same imagery of you being the life raft of this other piece of you, except now you're not calming them down. You're telling them, I need you to get angry. Imagine this piece of you that's horribly angry and just encourage her. Egg her on a little bit. You know, when like you're trying to get a friend a little bit angry and you're like, that is bullshit. There's no way you should have been treated that way. Think about how many women are like you that got put in this scenario. And just visualize her screaming, yelling, punching. And every once in a while, just let her know, of course you feel that way. You have every right to feel that way. And just keep asking her, what else are you angry about? What else are you frustrated with? And just see what pops up.
Yeah, I think I also have a lot of anger about how when I was, you know, when I first developed pain, not having support from my family, I think that was just added to the fear. And I know why I got the response that I got, which was some version of, you should be more resilient and you're making too big a deal out of this. But that's so unfair.
So unfair. I want you to visualize being in front of them now. This piece of you that's emotional and this piece of you that's taking care of that emotional piece. And I want you to imagine you protecting this emotional piece of you, almost putting a force field around her. And if there were no ramifications, if they just had to sit and listen, what would that emotional piece of you that's very angry say to them?
I just needed to be heard without judgment. And I just needed to know that I was loved in that moment. Like, I know that obviously they couldn't take the pain away, but just feeling like there was space for me to be in distress and to feel like they were listening. I think that a lot of the anger comes from feeling like I needed something very simple. I just needed someone to say, I hear you. That sounds awful. I'm sorry you're in pain. And the fact that that seemed so impossible or so much not available was shocking to me.
Mm.
And I kept asking for it in, you know, probably not in the clearest ways, but I just kept kind of going up to them and saying, well, I feel so scared. I'm in so much pain. I don't know what's happening. And it was so much like, and I understand I'm part of my family of origin. I understand why, you know, that's just pushing through. It's absolutely the way that we were taught how to function. And I know why that is the shorthand of our family. I know why that is how things get addressed. But that was so opposite from what I needed. And it felt just devastating to just not be heard and to just be told that I should buckle up and be more resilient. And like, I was being as resilient as I could be.
I want you to give this emotional piece of you what you wanted from your family. I want you to close your eyes and I want you to tell her, I'm listening to you. I understand how much pain you're in. You're worthy of my time. You're worthy of my attention. You're worthy of me taking you seriously. And I'm here to listen to you no matter what. And just really deliver that piece to this part of you that needs to hear it. And do you believe that? Do you believe that piece of you deserves to be heard and has value?
I do. I think it's taken me a while to say I do, to sort of give it permission. Because I think there's also the sense of, oh, if I give it permission to feel these things, then I'll be so overwhelmed.
Yeah.
That I'll never get out of those emotions. But I think a big lesson of this whole period is, you feel what you feel. You can't stop feeling something because you decide it's the wrong feeling. I think that is like a big part of me that probably not new. Like, I think I've sort of pushed it down many times before. It's just that this time I couldn't quite do it. You know, I think that part of me that is like, oh, but I feel terrified or I feel so frustrated or I feel vulnerable has popped up throughout the years. It's just, it was so much easier before. I got away with it for a long time of just saying, oh no, you, there's no room for you, go away. And of course, being in pain brings a whole new urgency to it of like, oh, okay, I think maybe I can listen to you.
You can hear Sarah starting to access some frustration, but you can hear the teariness and the sadness kind of coming in to almost overtake it. Why do you think it's so difficult to access anger for so many people?
Well, I was one of those people for sure. I mean, the way that I describe it to my patients and myself is that we need social connection in order to keep, to stay safe as a human. There's nothing else that brings us safety like other humans in that connection. And especially as a child, when, you know, when you're born, you will die if you don't have a social connection with your caregivers and your parents. You need to get them to love you in order to get them to take care of you so you don't die. So if your caregivers treat you in a way that you don't deserve, then that self-agency, that anger is not safe. To rise up with anger towards your parents who are your lifeline and potentially break that social connection, that's not safe for your unconscious brain's perspective. So as a child, it's pretty easy for our brains to learn that it's not safe to express anger. And for many people, they get taught a healthy way to express anger for sure. But then there can be all these different ways that that unsafety of expressing anger gets reinforced. Maybe the parents specifically teach them that it's not okay. They get sent to their room, or maybe their parent or sibling rises up in anger in a really scary way, or their religion teaches them it's not okay, or being a woman in this culture or a marginalized group in this culture that it's not okay to be angry. Or even I've had very, very big men that they don't want to scare other people. And so, I mean, there's just so many different reasons that our brain can learn and get reinforced that it's not okay to express anger.
So we've given Sarah empathy now and compassion, and she's able to express herself a little bit. And now we want to move on to giving her a sense of safety, teaching her how to start inputting these messages to her brain. But as you'll see, this isn't always a smooth transition.
But now that that emotional undercurrent, that feeling of your unconscious brain is taken care of a little bit, it's just soothed a little bit. We want to push back a little bit here and let that piece of our brain know, I know you're feeling this way and you have every right to feel that way, but we're also going to be okay.
Ugh, that's hard because there is a fundamental uncertainty to recovery, right? It's like, no, you know, sometimes I feel like I would take being in pain longer. Which makes no sense. I would take being in pain longer if someone could tell me the date by which I'll be out of pain, than being in pain a shorter amount of time, but not knowing exactly. Which sounds nuts when you say it, but that's just how it feels. You're like, I would kill for some certainty. And I think like that is there. That's a reality. You have to somehow accept uncertainty in some manner, which is so hard. So I think then you try to do this thing of, we're in pain right now, but we're going to be okay. That plus the uncertainty, that makes it very tricky for me to sort of sell that idea to my system, because it's like, okay, but like by when?
This is the grand negotiation, because you're right. There is no certainty you're going to be able to give your brain. It's the thing that freaked me out the most. Even when I'd say I'd be okay, I believed it like 92%. Some days I believed it 64%. And there's that gap left where you don't believe it. And this is where you start to negotiate with your emotional brain. Your emotional brain says, you're not giving me what I want. And you can say, I can't promise we're going to be okay later tonight. I can't promise we're going to be even okay later this week. I can't give you a timeline of when we're going to get better. But let me use my somatic tracking tool right now to show you that we're okay right now. Let me let you know that we're okay in the short term. If I can feel safe and comfortable even now while my symptoms are present, it's way easier for me to project in the future I'm going to be okay. And so I want you to just close your eyes and kind of throw your emotional brain a bone first. Let it know, I hear you. I know you're scared. And notice where in your body do you feel that kind of like leftover uncertainty, anxiety?
It feels like my chest.
And just feel that in your chest and let your brain know, of course you feel that way. Of course you're scared. I'm not giving you what you want. I know how frustrating that is. And we just spend a little time with this anxiety before we even move into the other sensations, and just feel your breath beginning to slow down. And this is where you start kind of showing your unconscious brain, you're okay. I want you to just feel your muscles go loose. Notice any bracing you're doing in your neck, your shoulders, particularly with pelvic pain in vulvodynia, you'll notice you're like clenching your abs or your hips to almost protect that area that feels sensitive or broken. And just feel with each exhale, feel those muscles let go and just let yourself know, I don't have anything to protect. There's no damage. There's just a sensation, and I don't have to protect a sensation. And feel your legs loosen up a little bit. Feel your toes, even the arches of your feet. Just use your exhales to just kind of let those muscles go. And you're just practicing letting your brain know we're safe now. See, I'm not even protecting anything and nothing bad's happening. And sometimes it spooks your brain, letting your shields down. Do you feel any emotion coming up?
Yeah, I feel a lot of sadness. I think when you said there's nothing to protect, or the part of you that you have felt is broken, I got really emotional then.
And so let that sadness come up. This is another way we signal to our brain that there's nothing to protect. We don't have to defend against sadness. This has been a long road. And just let that sadness come out. And each moment you just kind of allow these things to come up, you're teaching your brain, hey, we're safe right now because I'm not blocking anything. And each moment that goes by where your brain sees that your shield is down and nothing bad happens to you, it realizes, oh, we're safer than I thought. And feel that connection with yourself, that nice kindness you have toward the sadness as you allow it. And as that emotion kind of comes up and it plateaus and then it starts to peter out, see if you can sneak in a few messages of safety. Let your brain know we're going to do things a little bit differently, and that's why we're going to get better. We're going to be okay.
So you see in that exercise, it was difficult to accept messages of safety or even positive visualizations at first. Why do you think it's difficult for the brain that's been in chronic pain or been in trauma to even go there, to even fantasize about good feelings or good thoughts?
Gosh, that's so true. And, if the brain doesn't feel like it's been fully heard, it hasn't, because it's expressing a message. It's saying, we are not safe here. Hey, you need to pay attention to something. And if we haven't allowed ourselves to pay attention to that first, then it's really hard for the brain to dial down that signal and just, allow ourselves to go straight to the creating the new neural pathways of, sort of the positive pathways that we want. But I think you said it so adeptly, is the processing the trauma or processing the fear that's gone on. And we need to process that before we can then move on to then showing the brain that it's okay, that we can go forward. And it needs all of those parts often in order to get there.
And so this is the last piece of the puzzle. As you're watching it now, you're feeling this kind of sense of acceptance, not acceptance that it's damage, but acceptance that you're just letting whatever come up, come up. And now we want to just introduce a little bit of safety. I want you to just visualize a time in your life where you felt free, you felt unencumbered, you felt at play, you felt like you were safe. And what comes to mind?
I lived in New York City for a couple of years. I loved walking there. And I would like put my headphones on and listen to music and just sort of walk. I think one time I walked like 100 streets of Broadway and just kind of people watching and stopping by to get a grilled cheese. And it was just like nice weather.
Good.
Yeah.
So I want you to just picture that. Just visualize yourself walking down the street. You got your music on. What time of year is like your favorite memory from?
Like early fall. Like it's not very cold yet, but it's like nice that you can have, that it feels good to walk.
Yeah. And feel that temperature on your skin. Almost like that little bit of dimming of the light in September, October. And we're just reintroducing what safety and ease feels like to your brain. It's the lens we want you to start looking through. And just imagine being that version of yourself and just looking down now on your sensations. Just watch them from that lens. Nothing has to change. Just watch them through the eyes of a brain that feels safe. And how does that feel to watch it that way?
It feels good. It feels like I'm reconnecting with this part that I have felt that I'm not entitled to while I'm in pain.
Yeah.
It's a big part of me that thinks like, oh, fun, play, doing the things I love. These have to wait. It feels good to like invite that part of myself and be like, hey, it's okay. Like, I don't have to renounce all that is good and fun in life because of the pain.
This is why we do this annoying, hard emotional work, is because your brain gets its needs met And then the feeling of safety and fun and relaxation feels appropriate. You'll be listening to some music later, watching a movie, and they'll get the, kind of like a little bit of like childish giddiness back. And it'll be like, oh, that's what that felt like. And if you can start increasing those moments and having your symptoms present while you feel like you're at play, it speeds up the process incredibly. Because those things don't make sense. Your brain's like, wait, she's having a ton of fun, but the sensation's there. Something doesn't match up. Maybe she's not so broken. And so like the textbook version of this would say like, don't fear, have fun, be joyful. And sometimes there's a step before that, which is taking care of the trauma that you've been through and taking care of the emotions that have come up in that trauma so that your brain feels like its needs are getting met so that that fun and excitement and easiness feels appropriate to the brain. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think it's something that when I do somatic tracking often, right, like rather than going to go into the sensations, my anxiety peaks or it spikes. And then I think, oh, I can't do it right now because in my brain it's going to know that I'm anxious and as I'm doing this. So it's I think it's a good way to look at it and sort of try to sort of call in those emotions before I do it. And I think it relates to something else that I have been trying to do, which is I don't have to solve the whole thing today. I don't have to solve all of recovery today.
Yeah.
I can just solve like the next hour. I can just figure out what I want for lunch or what I want to watch or who I want to call on the phone. And I think that's solving part of your brain that is like, no, but we need to figure it all out. And I think sort of saying, no, actually we don't. That's not the homework. The homework is, what do you want to do right now? What is like the next best thing that we can do? That's it. That's all that you have to do, which is a big relief when you remember that, oh, I don't have to solve the next 5 years of my life. The next, you know, I don't have to figure out perfectly how recovery is going to go. Oh, that's very soothing because I know how to make myself happier right now versus like, I have no idea what I'm going to need, you know, in like a longer timeline.
Really liked what Sarah said in that clip about not needing to solve the whole problem.
Oh my gosh, me too. I was like, oh, I felt like my own like burden off my shoulders. Was, oh yes, right. I can just be in this moment right here, right now. Yeah, that was so awesome.
When you are dealing with uncertainty in your life and you need this kind of perspective check of I can just take care of the next 5 minutes. I don't have to solve every issue in your life. How do you get yourself back into that perspective? How do you kind of pull yourself out of the weeds of really getting scared with uncertainty?
You know, I learned this piece of information over the last couple of years that's really key for me. And it's the idea that there are no bad decisions. And when I first learned it, I was like, oh, no, that's not true.
There are bad decisions.
I know, right? But it's either if we choose to look at the world through the lens that either whatever decision we made went the way we wanted, or what lessons can I learn from it? And again, when we can really come to that just belief in that we are unconditionally lovable no matter what, we are all doing our best and our best is enough. And I think if we can really let go of that pressure we put on ourselves and really think about that. And so my unconscious brain automatically goes to, oh, there are bad decisions. But, you know, if I can take a breath and just sort of remind myself and kind of come back to, I'm doing my best. My best is enough. What can I learn from this? And that really helps me go forward in my life.
I grew up on the East Coast. So when Sarah's talking about this fall time in New York City, walking through the streets and just getting that almost sensory information back of what the air felt like or the leaves, kind of the crunch of the leaves sounded like. It brings me so much joy, but I know that when I was in pain, it was so difficult to even notice those things. And it wasn't until I started intentionally just seeking them out, even if they didn't hit as well as they used to. That was really kind of when my recovery turned. I know you're a big fan and colleague of Dr. David Clark, and he so emphasizes this idea of fun is so important in the chronic pain journey. What do you do for fun? What's your outlet? And how did you learn those things about yourself?
Well, it certainly took me years to learn how to have fun, I have to admit. I mean, when I was in medical school, I lived in this big house with seven people and we would watch The Simpsons every week. But I was the one that had to be paying my bills and I still had to be doing something productive. I couldn't just let loose. So it took me years. Absolutely. But again, I think that actually learning that I deserved to have fun and that I deserve to just relax and let go was a lot of it. One of the things that I just love so much is nature and just having sort of the mindfulness of nature. Just sometimes even I just look at my backyard and I just look at the birds and I listen to them sing and I look at the sun on the leaves or the rain or the, you know, gray clouds or whatever it is, but really just connect in with the sensory experience of nature is really a great thing that I love.
It's been so wonderful having you today. I just want to give you an opportunity to give a message to anybody listening who's going through their own journey, any hope or any wisdom you can provide them.
Oh, yes. Well, definitely a lot of hope. And when I first learned about this approach, I had sort of a cognitive dissonance. I mean, I almost sort of dissociated because I was like, what? This is what? Chronic pain being curable? No, that's not possible. But it was my best friend from medical school who was the one that told me, which is why I chose to let go of that part of the belief and then just dive in and explore. And what I say to people is pretty much everyone thinks that they're going to be the one that doesn't get better. And I actually developed my own chronic pain and fatigue after I learned about this work, because it's about our unconscious brain, not our conscious brain. So I went through this journey for a couple of years. And I also thought that I was the person that wasn't going to be able to get better. So that part is normal. And again, it's not easy, but it's definitely more possible than you think it is.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to the PRT podcast, brought to you by the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Center. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Becca Kennedy, for joining me today. You can find her center at resilience-healthcare.com. Finally, I want to give a special thank you to Sarah for allowing us to broadcast a piece of your journey. If you'd like to partake in a session for the podcast, message me on Instagram at johng.therapy, where I answer questions and provide information on the tools we cover in each episode. Thanks again for listening.